Ki Vai Bhava Ki
Jai
Mantra Shuna Bhagavatam Ki
Jai
Giridash Maharaj
Jai
Joy Nitai Go Premanandi Hori Om. Okay,
so tonight we're going to begin chapter 13, which is the final chapter in this pastime of Rudra Sura. We'll do the whole chapter tonight because there's not so many purports. Which means next Monday night we'll have a revision of chapters 7 to 13, and the following Monday, which is 2 weeks today, we'll have the closed book examination on the pastime of Rudra Sura. Rudra Sura key?
Yeah.
Closed book examination key?
Yeah.
So that also means you have 2 weeks to have your open book examinations finished also. And your oral presentation should be finished in 2 weeks also. What do you think? Another cool. One more week for what?
For the exam and for the
open book or closed book?
Both together.
What do you think is it around?
I agree.
You have to convince me though. Because why do you agree?
I think maybe 3 weeks is the time for us to do a proper time to study. We have studied Bhagavad Gita daily basis.
What do you think, Jagannath? Give me some reasons, don't just say I agree. Everyone agrees, obviously. I mean, if you have it 6 months' time, everyone will say yes, that's great. Give me some reasons.
Okay, but I
love it. Indian diplomacy. Very good. Okay. Let me think. Chaitan, what's the dates? What's the dates? So there. Someone else got a phone? Somebody? You can make Chaitan the secretary.
So, next week, 2nd, and after that, 9th, Monday.
So July the 2nd is next week?
Yes.
Then the 9th is one after?
Yes. And then 16th.
16th.
What number? What
number? Probably some print, is it? So then, is there anything coming in? July 16th? Does it mean anything in terms of...
Start on
29.
July.
2 weeks from now. Okay. So we have a consensus. Okay, so say when do you want to do the revision? Next week or the week after?
We can't do that.
Is it? 2 weeks from today. We'll revise the whole section 2 weeks from today. Okay, and then the following, which is what date?
16th.
So closed book 16. Closed book 16, open books 16th latest. That means you've got 3 weeks to have your open books ready and oral presentations finished.
Done.
Yeah, done. You say it every time. I'm yet to be convinced. Really?
Thank you.
Okay, so it means 3 weeks, everything. Oral presentations, everything. Finished in 3 weeks. Open books and closed books. Everyone's agreeing? In front of Guru Raj, everyone is agreeing? Huh? None of this late business. Alright, if we're going to all agree, then we all agree. Like that. Okay. So we'll let 3 weeks. Okay, so what does that mean? 16th?
16th
is the actual exam. Okay. I mean, I don't mind. It's up to you. But everything should be on time. No late business. Okay. So it means tonight we'll finish the chapter. It means next week we'll go into chapter 14. And then the following week we'll do the revision of chapters 7 to 13. Because then at the end of this chapter, well, the beginning of the next chapter, then Pariksit Maharaj will ask Shukadev Goswami to discuss who Rudra Sura was in the previous life. And then we'll go into the pastime of Chittaketu. Which will lead us into the remaining section of this canto. back.
Thank you.
A German atrophy.
Yeah, very successful.
Very successful. You've saved all the health issues.
And I have 3 days in our nursing day temple.
In
South Melbourne, South Germany.
Okay.
Nursing day.
On the farm.
Beautiful thing. Yeah, on the farm. And I had the chance of 3 classes or 2 classes.
Really?
Yeah. Can you grab a chair?
Can you grab a chair?
Can I? Is
everyone
fit?
So, again, excellent mood.
Not that one. Okay, so please tell everyone that the dates of the exam, the date is 6th of July the 16th. Okay, no problem. Okay, so tonight we go from verses 1 to 23. We're going to discuss the entire pastime of Richard Surah. It's a very special pastime which we're going through here in the Bhagavad Gita. Very important lessons we learned in this pastime of Richard Surah. The sixth canto is called Poshana because, first of all, we hear that Ajamiya is protected by Krishna. Poshana means protection. Now we're hearing how Indra is protected by the Lord. And then finally, we hear how Chitraketu is protected by the Lord. And ultimately, Richard Surah is protected. And we saw that Dichi was protected. So this is the message which is coming. So our faith should be increasing in the Lord's protection on a practical level. This should be the realization that we get from the sixth canto of the Bhagavad Gita, that we are protected by Krishna under all circumstances. And usually when we're studying the Bhagavad Gita, then Krishna will have certain things take place in our life coincidentally with the study of the Bhagavad Gita, so these lessons become realized. While we're studying, then Krishna may arrange certain things in our life that we may realize the depth of Krishna's protection more profoundly. Like that. So quite often when you're studying the Bhagavad Gita, the things you're studying, they come to life in your life. So you get some realization. This is the fourth type of exam. You have your closed book, you have your open book, you have your oral presentation. Then what goes on in real life, that's the actual examination, actually. Everything else is just preparation for the actual what takes place. Okay, Sri Sukadeva Swami said, O King Parikshit, who are so charitably disposed, when Vritrasura was killed, all the presiding deities and everyone else in the 3 planetary systems was immediately pleased and free from trouble. Everyone, that is, except Indra. Thereafter, the demigods, the great saintly persons, the inhabitants of Pitriloka and Bhutaloka, the demons, the followers of the demigods, and also Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva, and the demigods subordinate to Indra, all returned to their respective homes. While departing, however, no one spoke to Indra. So,
in this connection, Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur comments, Yama Masen Priyati Iti Indra Sesya Swa Vinusya. Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva, and the other demigods returned to their respective abodes. But Indra did not, for he was disturbed at having killed Vritrasura, who was actually a Brahmana. After killing Vritrasura, Indra went to the Manasarovara lake to become free from sinful reaction. When he left the lake, he performed an Ashwamedha Yajna and then returned to his own abode.
So what are the points in this verse?
Why does it say, what's the significance of that last word? When, while departing, no one spoke to him. Is that because there was a disturbance in the way? Is there any special significance? Buddha was not in a good mood, he was feeling very guilty. Okay. Others could sense his feeling of sense of guilt.
Okay.
The Sanskrit also gives some clue for that. You read the word by word translation. Swayam, Prabhupada translated as independently. And Prabhupada translates Swayam as independently within bracket without asking permission from him. So it looks, seems like the etiquette is to ask permission from Indra that now I am leaving because Indra's abode that they have come to. He is the ruler. So, but they did not ask permission from him. So that might explain the fact that no one spoke to him. It's in the word to word practice.
Yeah, I didn't read in the commentary. I didn't mention anything particular like that I can remember. Like that, maybe something will come. I can't remember. Any other point?
Yeah. What I think, Indra is very regretful for having killed Dhritarashtra because he's a Brahmin, and while fighting also he was behaving like Kshatriya also. Many times, and he was saved because of Narayan Kavach. Otherwise, he would have been. But because Krishna is protecting Indra, therefore he knows that he is being protected by the Lord, and therefore he is more regretful. So he goes to the lake, Manas Sarovar, and does the atonement by doing Ashwamedha.
Bit confusing in which category Dhritarasura belongs, because in previous previous chapters it was saying he's a demon, and now suddenly he's a brahmana. I mean, it's a bit confusing. You either say it's a brahmana or it's a demon, or I can't understand it.
Yeah, so the example is given of Prahlad Maharaj and Bali Maharaj. The body is a demon, but the consciousness is something higher.
How come the body is demon when he's born from a brahmana family?
No, he's born in a family of asura. It's a race. It's like some people here are born in Indian bodies. Some people.
He was not born in completely asura family. His mother was this, and
Vishwa
Rupa was considered brahmana.
So he's half.
This one is considered demon.
So he's half. Like if the mother's an Indian and the father's Australian, then you're half half. So he's half half, like that.
Or you can be half demon, half Brahmin.
Half demon, half demigod, that's all.
Yeah, but he was born from
Brahmin.
God.
Don't all of you get.
I'm from the Yajna. Maybe
you can take an example of
Ramana,
though. Ramana. He's also the same. His father was the Brahmin and mother is.
I'm I'm only powerful enough to take one or two of you at a time. When all of you ganging up on me together, at any point. It's very difficult to. It's not, to me, it's very easy to understand. The example is given by the Acharyas that Prahlad Maharaj and Bali Maharaj are both born in demoniac families, but they're devotees. Richasura is the same, born in a demoniac family. Or you have the body of the demon. He's obviously a demon by physical appearance, but he is a devotee by consciousness. So
but his father was a demon.
Don't worry about it. Just worry
the
about it. I'm not going to argue with any of you because I can't defeat all of you. But what I'm trying to say is the basic principle is there. So it's not hard for me to understand or to reconcile. So someone's born in a demoniac family, but he has a different consciousness. That's all. So it's not hard to understand.
But that was not a demoniac
family. Why don't all of you form a little group, and then afterwards you have like special satsang, and then write your papers and then please deliver them to us in the future. We'd be very happy to receive them.
His consciousness is more or less like Yudhishthira Maharaj, because he's doing Ashwamedha Yagna and he's feeling so regretful.
No, that's Indra, but we're talking about Richasura at the moment.
Consciousness is pretty high, as you say.
Yeah. Any other points?
Bhakti Vinaya Goswami Maharaj gave a lecture on this. Bhakti Vinaya Goswami Maharaj. He said, this pastime.
Who is
it? Bhakti Vinaya Goswami Maharaj.
The Russians are
listening. So, he said, this pastime is trying to establish that Bhakti is independent. That's the theme of this entire pastime. That Bhakti can appear anywhere. It has nothing to do with material things. Independent. And that is the principle being established.
Very good. Any other points? Okay. So, another important point, which is to be understood by this entire pastime, is that we must be very careful about committing offences. So Indra, he understands that he has committed a great offence because he has killed a very highly placed personality. So, as devotees, we have to be very conscientious about committing offences to others. Because subtly within the mind, quite often, we become very judgmental upon others according to external circumstances. But actually, this is the category of Vaishnava Aparadha. Now, we've given earlier, and we'll go over this again as we get closer to the exam, the six categories of Vaishnava Aparadha, which we went over earlier in this section, like that. But those six are broadly placed within three categories, which is vocal, mental, and corporal or physical apparatus. So it means even mentally, to think negatively towards another devotee, it's an apparatus, it's an offense. Okay. It is said within Kali Yuga, we don't get reactions for thinking mentally, offensively about other devotees. Now, why don't we get reactions for mentally thinking negatively towards another devotee? Because if we got the reactions for all the negative thoughts, we probably would not be sitting here speaking at this point in time, and probably gone already. Because in our mind, there's so many things going on, so many negative thoughts towards other devotees continuously, that we would, if we got all those reactions, it would be very detrimental to us. So therefore, in Kali Yuga, it is said, devotees do not get the reactions for the thoughts. But if you continue to think negatively towards devotees, it will come out in words and deeds. In other words, you will say negative things. And this is what happens. Devotees, they say negative things towards others. So sometimes I do it myself. And sometimes, when I hear other devotees do it, I also say, you have to learn, and we try to point this out to devotees, you have to learn not to think negatively. Because it's all what is going on in the mind, or what happens in the subtle, that happens in the gross. From the subtle comes the gross. So in your mind, if you're thinking continuously negative things, now. So you have to change the way you think. In other words, Prabhupada teaches us, and the Bhagavatam teaches us, instead of looking for the negative traits, train yourself to look for the positive traits. Because we can see negative traits within other people, but it's just as easy to see the good things. And we have to learn or train ourselves to see the positive things and to meditate upon those positive things and to search out those positive things. And that's the nature of a devotee, actually. He prefers to look at the good qualities as opposed to the bad qualities. And a devotee is, you realize the devotees are the most purified because they look for the good qualities more. And they're continuously focusing on the positive qualities or the good qualities of others. So you see advanced devotees, they tend to look like that. So if we do not do it then, our negative thoughts and negative attitudes will come out in negative speech. And then it may come out in negative actions. We may do one thing or do another thing very subtly or ferociously to inhibit another person's spiritual advancement. So it's a very negative thing. And actually it's born, as we know, from the main quality which brought us into the material world, which is matsara, or envy. When we have envy in the heart, then we look at others negatively. And we look for the faults in others, continuously. So this is called matsara. The Bhagavatam is for near matsara. It's for those who are free from envy. And this is the quality that you must develop if you want to taste the amrita, or the nectar of the Srimad Bhagavatam. You have to become near matsara. Near matsara means without envy towards others. So if you are envious towards others, you cannot taste the nectar which is in the Bhagavatam. You cannot relish the Srimad Bhagavatam. You cannot relish devotional service, actually. You cannot relish the holy name. You know, if you think that you can criticize others, even in the mind, and still taste the holy name, it's not possible. You will not develop a taste for the holy name. And this is what holds devotees back in their devotional service and their spiritual advancement. Now, how do devotees get held back in their spiritual advancement? They don't develop taste for the holy name. They don't develop a taste for hearing the Bhagavatam. Why is that? Because they still have envy within the heart. If you're envious towards anyone, that means you're still envious towards Krishna. You can say, well, I'm not envious towards Krishna, I'm only envious towards someone else. No, actually, you're still envious towards Krishna, simultaneously. It's not possible to have envy in the heart and not be envious of Krishna also. And you see the Kanishtha Adhikari, then he thinks, well, I respect the spiritual master and I respect all the advanced devotees. You see some junior devotees or neophyte devotees or less advanced devotees, they give so much respect to the senior devotees and to the gurus and to the sannyasis and to the deities like that, but they don't treat the other devotees very well. So it's a very low level of spiritual life, spiritual progress. When one is more advanced, then he will give respect to the Vaishnavas. There's actually one story which is told in the Mahabharata, a very interesting story. And Yudhishthira performed that huge sacrifice, the Rajasuya sacrifice. Was that, which one did he perform before the battle? He performed one before the battle and one after the battle. One was Ashwamedha and one was Rajasuya. I can't remember. Rajasuya was before,
yes.
And Ashwamedha was after.
Yeah.
Okay, so it was the Rajasuya. So he performed the Rajasuya sacrifice. So after doing the Jagya, one of the final parts of the sacrifice is that the wife of the king, who was Draupadi, she had to cook a meal, and the meal had to be fed to a brahmana. And if the brahmana was satisfied, there was a bell which was kept in the sacrificial arena, and that bell would ring automatically by itself if the brahmana was satisfied. So Draupadi cooked a wonderful meal. She was a very expert cook. And she cooked this meal, and then Yudhishthira brought the plate and he put it in front of the brahmana. And this is in the sacrificial ceremony assembly. And there's thousands of exalted personalities are there. And they took this simple brahmana, who was a very pure brahmana, and they gave him the plate of prasad. Draupadi had cooked it from her own hand. And then he took the prasad and he ate it, and then everyone was waiting for the bell to ring, but the bell did not ring. And then everyone was anxious. Yudhishthira was extremely anxious. We've done this huge Rajasuya sacrifice. We've had to basically conquer every king on the earth, made so much, many arrangements. Demigods are sitting here. Vishnu was sitting there. Krishna even was sitting there. Everyone was sitting there, practically. And the bell was not ringing. So then he began to ask the other Brahmins, what's taking place? And then the Brahmana said, someone must have offended this Brahmana. Someone has offended him. Otherwise, the bell would be ringing. If not that. So then, Yudhishthira was looking around. Who has offended this Brahmana? Who is like that? And then Draupadi was looking very upset. So he went to Draupadi. He said, what's happened? Why are you upset? Have you done something to this Brahmana? She said, in my mind, I thought I took such a beautiful offering and such nice prasad and given it to him. And when he took it, because he was a very simple person, he just mixed it all together. all these beautiful preparations, he just mixed it all together and then he tasted it. In her mind, she was thinking, how could he do this? I've cooked such a wonderful offering and he just mixes it all together. Like that. So Yudhishthira said, cook again. So she went, she cooked the whole thing again. And she brought it back and then they offered it to the Brahmin and the Brahmin mixed it all up together. And then he started eating it, and then the bell started to ring. Because even if you think negatively towards a devotee, then the bell will not ring. In other words, Krishna will not be satisfied. Even if you just think negatively towards the devotees, the bell doesn't ring. Krishna is not satisfied. So only when we treat the devotees properly, in our mind, in our thoughts, in our words, in our deeds, then the bell will ring. And when the bell rings, then... just like before I came to give class, I was taking prasadam upstairs with my very old friend, Jagannath Balabha Prabhu. We've been friends for as long as I've been a devotee. And another devotee came to take prasadam with us, and immediately he got up and when he got a mat and put it on the floor for him. And I just thought to myself, I still have so much to learn. He's so much more advanced than I am. Even to this day, he still teaches me so much. Real humility, not false humility. As soon as another Vaishnava came, immediately he went and got a mat and put it there for that. Exalted in consciousness. So this is the mood of the devotees. In thoughts, in words, in deeds, we have to learn to serve the other devotees. And then we'll become appreciated by Krishna, recognized by Krishna. Then the bell will ring. And then we will attain perfection. Any points?
Same thing he was talking about the compassion of Arjuna. Even though Duryodhana was very envious, he has given a lot of trouble to the Pandavas. For Arjuna, when Krishna placed the chariot in the middle of the battle, when he was looking, he was not just compassionate for all his relatives, he was even compassionate towards the animals. These animals are also going to die, and he was so worried for them. And also it says, at the end of the lecture, Prabhupada says, even though Arjuna is very compassionate towards them, but Krishna is not. Because Duryodhana has offended few devotees, Krishna, even though Arjuna will forgive, even a devotee forgives, even though he comes in offense to them, but Krishna will not forgive so easily.
You
don't want to kill them, but Krishna wants to be, he wants to wipe out. That's what Prabhupada said. He just wants to wipe them all of them. Because they have committed the Vaishnava offense.
That's good. It says in the Madhurya Kadambini that even if the devotee forgives you for committing an offense, the dust of the lotus feet of the devotee does not forgive you. So even if you commit offense towards the devotee, until Krishna forgives you, you're not forgiven. Even the devotee may forgive you, but you still have to bow before the devotee in order to be fully cleansed of the reaction. Any other points?
Do the reactions same counting by my words and action?
Each one becomes more serious.
Story of Bhrigumuni.
Yeah, Bhrigumuni. obviously the physical offense is the most serious. In other words, the greatest offense is to kill Vaishnava, or to kill the Buddha. That's the greatest offense. And then less serious, you can say, is the verbal offense, and less serious is the mental offense. But each one is gradually worse than the other. Any other point?
I remember Srila Prabhupada's confession. He was going on this front road. Chittari was there in the car, and they saw tears in Prabhupada's eyes when people were just moving around for watching some match and near MCG. And later on, one of the devotees asked Srila Prabhupada, why are you wasting so much time? Why these people are just wasting, like monkeys, going around and wasting time? Tears in people.
Any other points? Maharaj Parikshit inquired from Shukadeva Goswami, O great sage, what was the reason for Indra's unhappiness? I wish to hear about this. When he killed Vritrasura, all the demigods were extremely happy. Why then was Indra himself unhappy?
This, of course, is a very intelligent question. When a demon is killed, certainly all the demigods are happy. In this case, however, when all the demigods were happy because of Vritrasura having been killed, Indra was unhappy. Why? It may be suggested that Indra was unhappy because he knew that he had killed a great devotee and a Brahmin. Vritrasura outwardly appeared to be a demon, but inwardly he was a great devotee and therefore a great Brahmin. Herein it is clearly indicated that a person who is not called demonic, such as Prahlad Maharaj and Bali Maharaj, may outwardly be a demon or be born in a family of demons. Therefore, in terms of real culture, one should not be considered a demigod or demon simply according to birth. In his dealings while fighting with Indra, Vritrasura proved himself a great devotee of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Furthermore, as soon as he finished fighting with Indra and was apparently killed, Vritrasura was transferred to Vaikuntha Loka to become an associate of Sankarsana. Indra knew this, and therefore he was morose at having killed such a demon who was actually a Vaishnava or a Brahmana. A Vaishnava is already a Brahmana, although a Brahmana may not be a Vaishnava. The Padma Purana says, Sat Karma Nipuno Gutro Mantra Tantra Visharada Avishnavo Guru Nashya Vaishnava Swa Pacho Guru. One may be a Brahmana in terms of his culture and family and may be expert in Vedic knowledge, Mantra Tantra Visharada, but if he is not a Vaishnava, he cannot be a Guru. This means that an expert Brahmana may not be a Vaishnava, but a Vaishnava is already a Brahmana. A millionaire may very easily possess hundreds and thousands of dollars, but a person with hundreds and thousands of dollars is not necessarily a millionaire. Vritrasura was a perfect Vaishnava, and therefore he was also a Brahmana.
That was an interesting point here.
One should not judge by the external. Very nice, at the very end it is said that Vaishnava is greater than Brahmana. Vaishnava is already having Brahmana, but Brahmana may not become Vaishnava. I mean, they are not that exact.
Any other points?
One who has bhakti in the heart, all the good qualities are there.
So repeatedly the message has been given in this pastime that we should not see or judge the other devotees by externals. We shouldn't judge anyone by externals, actually. Just like I just had a week off, so I went away on a holiday. And I met some non-devotees who externally, you know, when I first met them, you might think, well, you know, they're not such. You know, but actually when I spoke to them and spent a little time with them and got to know them, very special people. So you cannot just judge externally. it took me 10 to do this very, a great deal of the time. We're always judging people externally, and rather than seeing that actually the internal quality is the most important quality. So we may say, well, someone's a non-devotee, but as Bhakti Tirtha Swami would point out to us, even someone who's a non-devotee, if they're pious, then they're virtually just a step away from becoming a devotee. In other words, if someone is a pious person, they can very easily be turned into a devotee. So we should not judge them externally and just say, oh, they're non-devotees, like that. But we should see their inner quality. Because that inner quality can very easily, with the right association, it can become devotional. So even with the non-devotees, we should be very careful about judging them externally. Sometimes as devotees, we become very judgmental. Then we use very derogatory terms and expressions, and the way we speak about the non-devotees, you know, we call them karmis. You know, we have a very derogatory kind of attitude towards them, like they're very, you know, unclean and untouchable. But in the biblical tradition, or in the Christian tradition, there is a saying that by the grace of God, I kept just trying to see, remember how it is said. Something like, there go I, but by the grace of God. In other words, we judge the non-devotees and we say, well, they're very fallen and they're impure, but actually we were no different to that only 10, 20, 30 years ago. We were practically on the same level as the non-devotees. So we must be very careful about being judgmental and seeing others simply on the external platform and lacking compassion, not seeing that actually these people, by the mercy of Krishna, they could easily become devotees once again. Easily. But we should not judge them externally. And with devotees, we have to be even more careful of judging devotees from an external point of view. Simply that they are from some material vision that we have, or some envy that we have, do we see these devotees are less than us or like that? In other words, a devotee, he tends, as he becomes more pure, he tends to see more of the good qualities of others. Just for the last week, I haven't been around any devotees except for my wife. So when you go away from the devotees, then you get great appreciation for the quality of devotees. What devotees are actually like, their good qualities, and then you appreciate them actually. And then when you come back into their association, you tend to see yourself as less significant. Because when we're regularly associating with devotees, what is our habit or our mentality? Whose phone is on? Okay. Quickly. So, take it for granted that. Yeah, when you go away from the words, then you tend to see the.
We appreciate the quality that
way. Yeah, we appreciate the qualities more. When
you come back and you come from us.
Yeah, we see ourselves as in a more formal position. Yeah. So, when you go away from the devotees for a period of time, then when you come back in, generally when we're associating with the devotees on a regular basis, because familiarity does breed contempt, then we tend to see ourselves in a particular position in relation to all the other devotees. So then you see, well, I'm a more senior devotee because I've been around for a longer period of time. And then you tend to see that these are the junior devotees. And then you get like a false sense of pride, that I'm a more advanced devotee, I am a more senior devotee, people are giving me more respect. And then you tend to see yourself in turn, it's almost like a material conception. But it doesn't necessarily mean that you're more advanced. Just because you've been around longer and people give you more respect, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're more advanced or you're getting more, you've made more progress than others. So I know for myself for the last week, because I've been away from the devotees, as soon as I come back to be with the devotees again, then I tend to see their good qualities more. And then you tend to see yourself as a less of a devotee. So sometimes it's good, you know. Can you see that? This chest on the other side. So sometimes it's arranged that we're not with the devotees, and this can be a healthy situation actually, because then when we do come back with the devotees, then we tend to appreciate them more. So this whole pastime of ritual sura is emphasizing this one point: you cannot judge the devotees externally. You have to look for the inner quality of the devotee. And sometimes when we're away from the devotees, when we come back and we see the inner qualities, it becomes so much more bright like that. Also, when we're away from the devotees, what do we learn? That we're not such a great devotee ourselves. You know, we think, oh, I'm a very advanced devotee, I'm a senior devotee. As soon as you're away from the devotees, you actually realize, as Srila Prabhupada said, one stick by itself can easily be broken. But you put all the sticks together and it's impossible to break. Like that. So then you realize, it doesn't matter how long you've been practicing Krishna consciousness, when you're away from the devotees, your Krishna consciousness can easily be wiped out. But if you're with the devotees, then you're protected automatically. Now, it is also pointed out in this pastime that we cannot judge the position of the spiritual master according to externals. Sometimes we hear this kind of criticism. It does come up from time to time. People say that those who are born in bodies outside of Indian bodies or in Bharat Bhasha, they are not qualified to be gurus. You know? Only someone who has an Indian body can actually be a guru. We do hear these things from time to time. That the Western gurus, they're not actually qualified to be gurus like that. But this is not the teaching of the Srimad Bhagavatam, as this pastime here clearly points out. And Srila Prabhupada does not emphasize that in any way. And Sanatana Goswami says that even a base metal, like bell metal, from an alchemical process, it can be changed in its constitution, and it can become something very valuable, like gold. So we cannot say that some personality, who externally may be born in a very fallen position, then you cannot say that that person becomes disqualified to become a guru. Because many of the gurus, they may have come from, you know, like, there's that one story we've told before, that 1966 in 26 Second Avenue, or 1967 in Hyde Ashbury in San Francisco, very early days of ISKCON, and you know, Prabhupada was having the program, he used to have his programs, and they did Anati, and then afterwards they were taking around the lamp, the Arti lamp, and then one of the people who had come to Prabhupada's program, they got their cigarette, and then they like that. Yeah, while he had his arm around his girlfriend, that person is now a guru in ISKCON. You know, so you can't say from the background the people come from. You cannot judge them like that. Right? It's not possible to see it like that. You cannot say, oh, because the person comes from this background or that background, they're not qualified to be a guru. No, by the alchemical process of Krishna consciousness, by the purification of chanting the holy name of Krishna, even someone who is born in the family of dog eaters, or even worse, cow eaters, then they can become purified, they can come to the platform of becoming a spiritual master by the process of purification. So sometimes we hear these bogus comments. Or then the other, sometimes we also hear, people say, if the devotee is not an Uttama Adhikari, or a topmost Vaishnava, he's not qualified to be a guru. So that's not the philosophy of the Bhagavatam either. Srila Prabhupada never emphasized that either. Sometimes people would say to Prabhupada, have you seen Krishna? And Prabhupada would say, even if I say yes, how will you know? So So even externally, someone says, yes, I've seen Krishna. But how do you know they've seen Krishna? So many people in India say, yes, I've seen Krishna. You know, people say, I dance with Krishna. People say that. They say, I dance with Krishna. Or Krishna speaks to me. You know, even I've been in Vrindavan, you know, in front of Radha Shama Sundara and Krishna Balaram Mandaji having darshan. And there's one Mandaji standing next to me and she's talking to Krishna. Having a whole conversation. You know, talking, hey Krishna, hi Krishna. And she's saying all these things, having this whole conversation with Krishna. And then the doors, you know, after the aarti, the doors begin to shut. She says, nay, nay, Krishna, nay, nay. But it's bogus. Unless she is actually on that platform, but, you know, generally it's not like that. Just like, you know, when Prabhupada opened that Krishna Balaram Mandir, and they used to have kirtans in the aartis, and sometimes you see the people roll around on the ground during the aarti, on the ground, they roll up and down the ground like as if they're in ecstasy. So the devotees went to Prabhupada, and they said, Prabhupada, you know, people are rolling on the ground. Prabhupada said, kick them in the head. You know, this external show of devotion. Prabhupada was so, you know, Prabhupada, he gave lecture here, I think it was in Melbourne. He said, I kick on your face, what will you do? He said, I will kick on your face, what will you do? Prabhupada would say this. So we should not be sentimental in Krishna consciousness. So when someone says only an Uttama Adhikari can become a guru, that's not the philosophy of the Bhagavad Gita. That even one who is a Majjhima Adhikari, he can become a guru. The Uttama Adhikari comes down to the Majjhima platform to preach Krishna consciousness. And a Majjhima, one who has actually attained the platform of Nishtha, or steadiness in Krishna consciousness, he may not be. Even when we see some of our gurus, they fall down. Because they're not Uttama Adhikari, they're Majjhima Adhikari. They fall down, but most of them are successful. Most of them are Nishtha. They're fixed in Krishna consciousness. And gradually, by following the Uttama Adhikari, and because they're more advanced than us, we will also attain perfection. So people say all these things. Sometimes you hear, oh, this one cannot be a guru and that one cannot be a guru. The bottom line is you don't want to surrender. That's the bottom line. And we won't even get into the Rikvik philosophy. No. Although I will say something bad, because it is a bogus philosophy. To say that only Prabhupada is the qualified person. It's an insult to Prabhupada, actually. Because Prabhupada himself made the system that his disciples would become gurus. And if they were good enough for Srila Prabhupada, then we take it they're good enough to everyone else. Prabhupada says, if you love me, love my dog. You love Prabhupada's service. Because it's actually an insult to Prabhupada to say that Prabhupada could not create qualified spiritual masters. So this Rikvik philosophy actually is unacceptable. And ISKCON has to be very heavy on it, like that. We're very tolerant on many things, but this one particular thing we cannot be tolerant on. Hari Sourakuru is very heavy on this point. Very heavy at this point. They're costing our movement millions of dollars, this whole Rikvik thing. It's actually a great disservice for all, but, you know, so it has to be fought very fiercely. Annie Rudakuru is very heavy on this point. Even one person who's coming around, he's a Rikvik person. I said something to Annie Rudakuru we're having a discussion about. Annie Rudakuru said, I'm going to tell him not even to come to the temple. And I was thinking, well, that's quite a heavy reaction. You know, to be like that's very heavy. Then I thought about it, I thought, no, actually he's correct. You know, that's actually the correct stance to take. You have to be heavy sometimes to protect Prabhupada's society. We can't be sentimental.
When we were in Vrindavan, one evening, one Mataji, you know, she just fell down in front of us. Her face distorted, everything. She fell down and she started shaking. And I was thinking whether this is faking ecstasy or not. And then actually it turned out that she was really, really sick. Really sick. She could have had epileptic attack or anything. So, I mean, if someone comes and kicks her in the head because he thinks that she's faking, that's even worse. I mean, for injury, I mean, be careful with that, kicking the head, you know?
I'm very careful about
that. I mean, and Prabhupada may kick someone, but we...
I don't think Prabhupada ever kicked anyone. But Prabhupada was just making a point, that's all. I don't think any of his disciples went into the temple and kicked anyone. Prabhupada was just making a point, don't tolerate that kind of thing, that's all. Don't be sensitive.
Why
is Rupi
philosophy? Why is he not accepting the Sikh philosophy?
Because it's not what Prabhupada taught.
Somebody wants to read Prabhupada books and then they just want to follow him. He's also the senior guru.
But if you follow Prabhupada, then you have to follow Prabhupada's teachings. And what's Prabhupada's teaching? His teaching wasn't that the disciple succession finished with him. That wasn't his teaching. So then it's not following Prabhupada's teachings, so that's why we have to reject this philosophy.
They want to take Prabhupada as a guru, I don't think that's wrong.
Yeah, that's what they're saying. They're saying Prabhupada is their guru.
Mm-hmm.
They take initiation from a picture of Prabhupada or something like that. But it's not acceptable.
In my class, the people they take from Maharaj, then they claim themselves.
Before Sarupa, they take from him, and then after their initiation finished, then they said, "Oh, I have no relation with that Maharaj." But yeah, it's like that.
Yeah,
so it's a deviation. Therefore, we have to treat it as it is. It's a deviation. It has to be treated very carefully. Any other points?
About external appearance, there is a nice story in Chaitanya Charitamrita about Munri Vidya Nidhi. And
that's not Chaitanya Charitamrita.
Yeah.
That's different. Maybe Chaitanya Bhagavad.
Also, Krishna says in Gita, Mahi Patka Vipasritya. Krishna himself is saying that I don't see a person by the external. Like, if they have devotion, then they can still come back to attain Supreme.
Even if one performs most abominable activity, so is my devotee.
That is not that person saying.
No, but that's the philosophy.
Yeah.
Is there any concept of the diminished guru in the sastra?
Of the
diminished guru.
I'm not sure. What does it mean?
In the sastra.
Yeah, but I don't know what you're asking. So.
I'm asking, is there any concept? Like a diminished guru, the guru is diminished in station, diminished guru.
Yeah, but what do you mean by that? I don't know what you mean.
His guru is not actually fallen, but he's diminished in station. Is there any concept like that?
Yeah, but how do you mean he's diminished in stature? What do you mean by that?
Because I came across a Rithvik in my last Indian yatra. Talking to me on the railway station, I had no idea that he was a Rithvik. And he started talking about the diminished guru. And then my train came and I boarded the train. So I thought that was.
I don't know. They say all sorts of things like that. Like one came to the farm, he came to stay at the farm, then after speaking to him, I realized he was a Rithvik. So I gave him. Prabhupada's order, which is the GBC response to the final order, the paper that they wrote. I gave him the other paper and I said, read it. And I said, please give it back to me when you finish. He supposed to give it back to me after reading it, asking to give it back. But then I discussed with him and he was saying all the different things. And I actually defeated him. And he admitted that he was defeated also. But then, you know the philosophy. This is, even when they're going down. Yeah, but... So they say all sorts of things. We have to become learners. We have to read Prabhupada's order. I've never read the final order, but I've read Prabhupada's order, so I know how to at least deal with it. How to preach to them and defeat them. And they may not accept defeat, but by logic we can defeat.
So what is Prabhupada's final order in essence?
What's that?
What does Prabhupada's final order say in essence?
They say that his final order is that he was the guru for everyone from now on. That was his final order. But on May the 25th, Prabhupada said to the GBC meeting's leaders, he said, "Ask me any questions concerning when I am not here, because I will depart soon." So then on May the 25th, they came to Prabhupada, and they asked five questions. And I think two were in relation to the BBC, about publications after Prabhupada left. In other words, could authors other than Prabhupada be printed using the BBC logo? Prabhupada said, yes, that is acceptable. It has to be a committee to authorise who can write, but the BBC can print other authors besides Prabhupada. And then other questions were in relation to Prabhupada's process of initiation after Prabhupada left. And Prabhupada was very clear what he said. And if you read, I mean, this conversation, the conversation in Tehran, I think it is, in Iran when Prabhupada was there, and someone asked him directly, they said, what will happen? It was directly asked. Like, he was asked the question numerous times when he was with us. And in this particular conversation, they said, what will happen after you leave? Who will take over? And then Prabhupada said, they will. He said, my followers, they will, I think. He said, they will become the gurus. He said it directly, I think. So it wasn't ambiguous. It wasn't like he didn't say it. And it wasn't like he changed his mind in the last 6 months or the last couple of days or something. It wasn't like that. But they basically, it's just word jugglery. That's what my Advaita philosophy is. It's just word jugglery. That's what all Rigvedic is. It's word jugglery. And as Tamal Krishna has pointed out, that he's actually the Rigvedic Acharya, because he's the one who came up with the word. You know, the letter where it mentions Rigvedic Acharya, Prabhupada in 1977, he wasn't even writing the letters. Tamal Krishna wrote the letter, read it to Prabhupada. Prabhupada would make any adjustments and then send out. So Prabhupada didn't even write the letter. And they based the whole philosophy on this one letter, which Prabhupada didn't even write. So, you know, what's the whole philosophy about? And Tamal Krishna just happened to use that word in the philosophy, in the letter. You know, it says a Rigvedic Acharya, that's all it was. Because Prabhupada was ill, so then he said that he could not directly initiate at that time. In other words, they could not come directly to Prabhupada. So he said 11 people would be Rigvedic Acharyas. Right? Which means you approach them, they will do the jagya on behalf of Prabhupada, they will give the beads on behalf of Prabhupada, they will give the name on behalf of Prabhupada, and you will become Prabhupada's disciple. But they will do the Rigvedic means an officiating priest. So Prabhupada, he said, okay, yes. Tamal Krishna Maharaj used that word, Rigvedic. He heard it in the Bhagavatam. And then Prabhupada said, yes, Rigvedic. And then he read the letter, and then Tamal Krishna Maharaj, Prabhupada said, yes, that is acceptable. Send the letter out, and then that was it. But then Prabhupada knew there was nothing about, okay, when I'm gone. That wasn't in the letter. When I'm gone, this will be the system. He never said that. So it's a deviation, and has to be dealt with very strictly.
Stressing on this right now, you know, because I was, one of the guys was telling me that this is what exactly Prabhupada said, that you will be initiating with your beings, you will be initiating on my behalf, but they are not concerned about what Prabhupada's final lesson was, so he is just considering that letter to be the final notice.
So, main
goes
to the philosophic philosophy, and then there is some. It's from Bangalore. And there is a documentation, like complete documentation for like around 45 minutes. There, like the GBC or you can say the original ISKCON, they are cutting their each and every point with a logic. Right from the point where they are saying, okay, from this particular time, this temple is independent. From there, from last 30, like 20, 25 years, they're taking on like maybe say 10 and 12 different points. Okay, the trick says this is the reality. And you can, by reading that, you can easily like feel like, okay, this all is going crap. This is nothing true in that. So it's a complete documentary problem.
Hmm. Yeah, there shouldn't be any confusion about the situation. But it wasn't what Prabhupada wanted. So if it was what Prabhupada wanted, then it would have been installed. And Prabhupada would have given explicit instructions about it. You know, in 1977, Prabhupada was about to leave, he would have started saying, you know, do it like this, do it like that. He never said like that. everyone sufficiently satisfied? Have we destroyed Ritvik? I can really get into it, but you know, you don't have time. Okay. So we're up to verse 4.
Yeah.
Okay, we've got 20 verses to go. Sri Shukadeva Goswami answered, when all the great sages and demigods were disturbed by the extraordinary power of Ritrasura, they had assembled to ask Indra to kill him. Indra, however, being afraid of killing a Brahmana, declined their request. King Indra replied, when I killed Vishwarupa, I received extensive sinful reactions, but I was favored by the women, land, trees, and water, and therefore I was able to divide the sin among them. But now, if I kill Ritrasura, another Brahmana, how shall I free myself from the sinful reactions? Sri Shukadeva Goswami said, hearing this, the great sages replied to King Indra, O King of Heaven, all good fortune unto you, do not fear, we shall perform an Ashwamedha sacrifice to release you from any sin you may accrue by killing the Brahmana. The rishis continued, O King Indra, by performing an Ashwamedha sacrifice and thereby pleasing the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is the Supersoul, Lord Narayan, the Supreme Controller, one can be relieved even of the sinful reactions for killing the entire world, not to speak of killing a demon life, Ritrasura. One who has killed a Brahmana, one who has killed a cow, or one who has killed his father, mother, or spiritual master, can be immediately freed from all sinful reactions simply by chanting the holy name of Lord Narayana. Other sinful persons, such as dog eaters and chandalas, who are less than sutras, can also be freed in this way. But you are a devotee, and we shall help you by performing the great horse sacrifice. If you please Lord Narayan in that way, why should you be afraid? You will be free even if you kill the entire universe, including the Brahmanas, not to speak of killing a disturbing demon like Ritrasura. So, Srila Prabhupada emphasizes that one cannot commit sins from the strength of chanting the holy name.
Yeah.
Like that. So you cannot think that I will do this and then that's okay because I'll chant or I'll do some devotional service and then I'll be saved from the reaction. Even like I remember when I first joined and we were doing the marathon and distributing books. So then I was becoming proud because we were the Sankirtan devotees and we were going out distributing so many books. So then at the end of the day we'd come back after doing so much book distribution, distributing so many books, and we'd come back at the end of the day, and then normally I would not enter the deity kitchen if I was contaminated. Not the deity kitchen, but the kitchen. Both kitchens should be the same standard. So the kitchen I would not walk into if I was contaminated, but I came back from Sankirtan for book distribution, and I hadn't taken a bath because, you know, I'd been out all day distributing books, and then I was impure because I'd been out on the street all day and not pure. But then I thought in my mind, but I've been doing so much service for Krishna, I've distributed so many books, I can just walk in there and just take the Mahaprasada. So then that was committing an offence or an aparad on the strength of chanting or on the strength of bhakti. And then Krishna, within my heart, he revealed to me, actually, this is not the right mentality. You know, who do you think you are? You can just walk into my kitchen anytime, you know, in your contaminated state. So sometimes we get into these mentalities in so many different subtle ways, in devotional service, and we start taking shortcuts. Because we think, oh, I can do this, I can do that, but that's okay because I do this service. You know? So many things. You know, I've seen devotees do so many things over the years. And they think, oh, I can do this, I can do that. Just like sometimes devotees, they're up in the prasadam hall, you know, and they've eaten, and they think, oh, no one's around, so I don't have to go all the way down and wash my hands and come back up. I can just go over and serve myself. But I've seen devotees do that. It's not acceptable. You know, these are not the standards. But then in your mind, you think, oh, I'm doing so much service. You know, I'm such a good devotee. I did so much preaching and so many things. I can, you know, take some shortcuts. But no, actually, you are offending Krishna and Krishna's devotees. Okay. So to be very careful about this mentality or this consciousness coming into devotional service. Right? It can come in so many different ways. Sri Shukadeva Goswami said, encouraged by the words of the sages, Indra killed Rishvasura, and when he was killed by the simple reaction for killing a Brahmana, Brahmacharya certainly took shelter of Indra. So, Indra is about to suffer. Because what has he done? He's committed a great path, a great sin. So then what takes place is after he commits a sinful reaction, the sinful activity, then sin personifies as a very unclean woman, and then she chases him in this sinful form like that. So, Prabhupada is pointing out in this section that when a devotee suffers in this way, when he gets reactions, he sees that as being Krishna's mercy. So Indra, even though the other demigods and the other sages, they say, don't worry, you just kill Vritrasura, we'll protect you, we'll do the judges and we'll protect you, we'll counteract the sin. But actually, a devotee, he doesn't see it that way. A devotee actually understands, Indra thinks in his mind, he thinks, I've done the wrong thing, I have committed a sinful activity, and now I will get suffering. So when a devotee is suffering, he sees that is Krishna's mercy to purify me. So that is actually the consciousness of the devotee. So Indra is seeing it in the correct way. This sinful person is coming and is thinking this is actually correct. I should be getting this kind of reaction for what I've done to this great soul of Rishvasura. Following the advice of the demigods, Indra killed Rishvasura and he suffered because of this sinful killing. Although the other demigods were happy, he could not derive happiness from the killing of Rishvasura. Indra's other good qualities, such as tolerance and opulence, could not help him in his grief. So we see that sometimes that we commit an offense or make a mistake in devotional service, and then we cannot enjoy. And Krishna totally takes away all of our pleasure or taste. Even though you may have so much in your life, you may have so much reason to be happy, but if you've committed an offense to a devotee, then you cannot be happy. And we all know that. Externally, everything may appear as it is, or perfect. Externally, someone may be looking at us and thinking, oh, everything's so good for this devotee. But inside, because we know we've committed an offense to some other devotee, so much turbulence is taking place within the heart. So this situation is taking place to Indra. Even though externally he's the king of heaven, he has heaven itself, he has swagger itself, he has so much opportunity for material enjoyment, but because an offense has been committed, there's no peace in his heart. Same thing we saw in the Bhagavatam with Yudhishthira Maharaj. After the battle with Kurukshetra, Yudhishthira had won the kingdom, but he was not happy. Because so much bloodshed has taken place. So sometimes, even though externally everything looks perfect in devotee's life, but we know ourselves, when we commit even a small offense, we can't be satisfied, we can't be happy.
But isn't it that Lord Krishna told you to do this? When he said...
Yeah, there's no mistake on Indra's behalf. But if you imagine, even if you, just like Arjuna, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Arjuna had to kill Bhishma,
mm-hmm.
and that was Krishna's order,
mm-hmm.
but he did not enjoy it, even though Krishna himself said, do it. But still, for Arjuna, it was just suffering.
Yeah, but
I know what you're saying, but you just listen to what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
Understand the point.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, but just understand the point.
Yeah.
Like that.
But Arjuna didn't have to go and neck down in the lotus and everything. And Indra was burdened by the sin and Arjuna wasn't. That's the difference.
Yeah, Indra's not a pure devotee. Arjuna's a pure devotee. So there's a difference. We could discuss it more, but I think we'll just leave it at that.
Did Vishnu Okay.
Yeah, we can talk about it in another class. Following the advice of the demigod Indra, Kiel, and Prichasura. Did you read that one?
Yes.
Indra saw personified sinful reaction chasing him, appearing like a Chandala woman, a woman of the lowest class. She seemed very old, and all the limbs of her body trembled, because she was afflicted by tuberculosis. Her body and garments were covered with blood. Breathing an unbearable fishy odor that flew to the entire street, she called to Indra, "Wait, wait. O king," Indra first fled to the sky, but there also he saw the woman of personified sin chasing him. This witch followed him wherever he went. At last he very quickly went to the northeast and entered the Manasa Sarovara Lake. So Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur explains that this particular lake was protected by the followers of Lord Shiva. So no one could enter that place unless they were given permission. So Indra entered that place. He could enter because he was given permission, but no one else could follow like that. So he was protected at that time in that particular place.
Is it the same thing in Vrindavan?
Mansarovar? I don't think it is.
It's in Himalayas.
Yeah, it's protected by Shiva, this particular place. So. Always thinking of how he could be relieved from the sinful reaction for killing a Brahmana, King Indra, invisible to everyone, lived in the lake for 1,000 years in the subtle fibers of the stem of a lotus. The fire god used to bring him his share of all yogis, but because the fire god was afraid to enter the water, Indra was practically starving. As long as King Indra lived in the water, wrapped in the stem of the lotus, Nahush was equipped with the ability to rule the heavenly kingdom. Due to his knowledge, austerity, and mystic power, Nahush, however, blinded and maddened by power and opulence, made undesirable proposals to Indra's wife with a desire to enjoy her. Thus, Nahush was cursed by a Brahmana and later became a snake. So it's an interesting pastime. It's in the commentary by Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur. It explains a little bit about what took place. So if you get time, you can read it. Indra's sins were diminished by the influence of Rudra, the demigod of all directions. Because Indra was protected by the goddess of fortune, Lord Vishnu's wife, who resides in the lotus clusters of Manasa Sarovara Lake, Indra's sins could not affect him. Indra was ultimately relieved of all the reactions of his sinful deeds by strictly worshipping Lord Vishnu. Then he was called back to the heavenly planets by the Brahmanas and reinstated in his position. O king, when Lord Indra reached the heavenly planets, the saintly Brahmanas approached him and properly initiated him into a horse sacrifice, Ashwamedha Yajna, meant to please the Supreme Lord. The horse sacrifice performed by the saintly Brahmanas relieved Indra of the reactions to all his sins because he worshipped the Supreme Personality of Godhead in that sacrifice. O king, although he had committed a gravely sinful act, it was nullified at once by that sacrifice, just as fog is vanquished by the brilliant sunrise. King Indra was favored by Narichi and the other great sages. They performed the sacrifice just according to the rules and regulations, worshipping the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the Supersoul, the original person. Thus Indra regained his exalted position and was again honored by everyone. In this very great narrative, there is glorification of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Narayana. There are statements about the exaltedness of devotional service. There are descriptions of devotees like Indra and Vrichasura. And there are statements about King Indra's release from sinful life and about the his victory in fighting the demons. By understanding this incident, one is relieved of all sinful reactions. Therefore, the learned are always advised to read this narration. If one does so, one will become expert in the activities of the senses, his opulence will increase, and his reputation will be widespread. One will also be relieved of all sinful reactions. He will conquer all his enemies, and the duration of his life will increase. Because of this because this narration is auspicious in all respects, learned scholars regularly hear and repeat it on every festival day. Sri Vritra Suruti.
Nothing can protect
you
from suffering due to the
simple
actions, I think it's...
If you can offend to a devotee.
No, but he killed, he committed
simple... Everyone's a victim.
He committed simple activity of killing a brahmana. And you know, the sin personified was chasing him. And he couldn't put Narayan Kavacha just to protect himself.
Yeah, he was protected because he went, I'm too tired to go into it in great detail at the last minute of the class, but we should just stick on the basic principles instead of the details. This is what we're meant to learn from the Bhagavatam, the principle. So the principle is that if you offend a devotee, you will get reactions. That's the principle. That's what we should learn. We don't have to analyze, what happened with Indra, what happened with Richasar, and what happened with Nahush, and what happened with Arjuna and like that. It's not necessary. We should just get the principles from the Bhagavatam. But we can discuss them all tomorrow if you want to.
The
reason
number says that how it all started with Indra,
yeah, it caused himself a lot of problems. Okay, so tomorrow night we'll begin chapter 14. And then, in 2 weeks' time, we'll have a overview of the... Of that. We'll talk about tomorrow night. Sure, Prabhupada.
Yeah.